FTC versus Tankersley. Tankersley, Mr. Bauer.
May it please the court, attorney Steve Bauer on behalf of William Tankersley. This is an appeal from an FTC civil litigation brought in the Northern District of Indiana. Summary judgment was granted by the district court magistrate after reviewing voluminous documents, depositions, affidavits, and written expert opinion. Obviously, a de novo review on this appeal. In examining all of the briefs and the materials, Judge, Your Honors, I really think the heart of this litigation or this issue has to do with whether or not the telemarketing program and the materials provided to the consumers could in fact help them in doing well on postal examination 470.
I don't see how that's the issue. The issue is whether it's misleading, whether advertising is misleading. It might not be, I mean, their service might not be worthless, but if the advertising is misleading, then they're violating the FTC Act, aren't they?
That's correct, Judge. There isn't any doubt about that, that if, in fact, it is misleading, then there is a violation. If so, then we're back. If Your Honor views that that's what the major issue is, then all of the detailed examinations as to what the advertisements were in the newspaper and the fact that in almost three-fourths of them there was specific language that they were not affiliated with the post office, the script used by the telemarketing people when they answered the phone, in which the government wants to say that they represented that employment was likely within 2 weeks, where in fact the language said that asked if they were able to be employed or be available within 2 weeks if employed. All of these factors, Judge, I think clearly raise issues of fact that should be tried by a fact finder and should not be resolved on summary judgment. There is a huge quantity of testimony and evidence presented by Tankersley at the trial level via numerous affidavits of employees showing exactly what was done and what wasn't done that raises issues of fact whether or not what was said was misleading or fraudulent.
There are two things that concern me. One is advertising in a locale when there aren't any jobs open.
In fact, the evidence showed that from time to time there were locales in which jobs were not open. There was also evidence presented that in certain locales jobs were available for up to 18 months.
But the advertising seemed to occur rather pervasively without regard to whether or not there were openings. And the second part of that, my concern, is on this test 470, is it?
Yes.
That apparently wasn't given very often, and yet the whole thrust of your operation is to teach people how to pass or get 95% or better on test 470.
That's correct.
Why would they advertise that when there's no knowledge at all that test 470 is about to be given?
Judge, the way that was addressed is twofold. You asked whether or not there were job openings available. That's the reason why the 800 hotline was set up, in which Rachel Hill was assigned, and she on a weekly basis made anywhere from 240 to 280 contacts within the Postal Department to find out what was being available, and that information was readily available to the consumers pursuant to the hotline. Back to the test 470. There were periods of time in some locales in which the tests were not offered, and that a lot had to do with what the hiring practices were or the needs at the particular time. But when you look at the overall evidence on that, there is sufficient number of job openings that does not make that presentation just fraudulent up front. There was no specific representation that I'm aware of in the materials that are in the record that absolutely guaranteed that at a particular time that particular, you know, a particular job was open. So once again, my drift in this is really a matter of, you know, we've got to weigh the facts in here and then make a determination. There is certainly disputes as to material fact that would prohibit summary judgment.
Well, there are disputes over facts, but I don't see how you could possibly avoid the conclusion that there were misrepresentations. You know, we guarantee in writing you'll score 95% to 100% on the exam.
Judge, that language is in the refund provision of the materials that were sent out.
So what?
Judge, if what it said is, if you do not achieve the 95% test result, we guarantee the refund.
That sounds phony, because only about 1% or something of the people who take the test score that well.
That was the government's expert that'll find that.
And you would dispute that?
Judge, I'm not. Our expert rendered opinion not quite to that effect as to what exactly the percentage would be above 95, but he rendered the opinion that all of the testing materials and the practice to be done would be of substantial help in doing on the test.
That's not what your advertising says. Your advertising says, you know, our materials will be a substantial help to you. You say, we guarantee in writing you'll score 95 to 100%. Or your money will be immediately refunded. That sounds pretty strong.
And that's what they did.
They refunded the money?
They refunded the money.
Immediately?
And there's all...
Immediately?
Yes. There's affidavits or depositions of three of the employees to that effect. The government's position was that they didn't refund it immediately. Those are issues of fact to be tried by the fact finder.
Of course, that presupposes that they actually were able to take the test.
That's right.
Which most of them didn't.
Well, that was up to them. Of course, anytime you get materials that are represented that is going to help you on a test, whether it's an SAT for college or whatever it is, and if you don't do anything, if you don't practice and you don't read and you don't work on it, it's not going to help you. So, that's where we are. Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Bauer. Mr. Mill Wagner.
Thank you, Your Honor. Lawrence DeMille Wagman for the Federal Trade Commission. There's one point I'd like to clear up first, and that is, I believe that Appeal 011663, that's the Federal Trade Commission's cross appeal in this matter, still is live with respect to the $25,000 award that the district court made to the law firm of Cohen and Theros.
Yeah, sure, but the problem I think with that appeal is that he froze the money at the outset of the litigation before there was a determination as to how much of it was Tankersley and how much belongs to consumers, the victims of the fraud. So when that happens, isn't the lawyer entitled to keep them, you know, use the money for the defense, rather than have it yanked back from him maybe years later when it's determined that really the consumer should have had all this money?
Your Honor, the money that went to the lawyer was in a lawyer's trust account, paid in advance of services provided by the lawyer. There were two releases of funds to Mr. Sarkisian's law firm prior to final judgment in this case. Federal Trade Commission is not disputing those two releases. What then happened was, after the court entered final judgment, the court stated, the court ordered that the remaining funds, the funds that still remain, the funds that the evidence showed were funneled from the proceeds of defendant's scheme into various accounts controlled by William Tankersley and his wife Linda. The court held that those remaining funds were in constructive trust. At least from that point on, it was inappropriate for the court to release any of those funds to pay defendant's attorney.
But were they released to pay for previous services? The $25,000?
It doesn't matter, Your Honor.
No, but answer my question. Was it released for previous services?
The $25,000, I believe, were released for previous services.
Right.
The law firm has now applied for a release of an additional $200,000 for future services to be provided. That's correct, Your Honor, but the issue is the same, because the release was made, the $25,000 release was made after the court imposed a constructive trust
but
on
also the after the lawyer had rendered service in expectation that he would be able, that he would be paid out of the fund.
That's not clear at all, Your Honor. It's clear, presumably, that he had expectations that he would be paid, but the evidence shows that Mr. Tankersley and the corporate defendants secreted funds offshore. They were ordered by the court to account for and repatriate those funds. They refused to do so. Mr. Tankersley also, all the way up through the time of that release of the $25,000, he was free to get a job and to
earn
money.
That wasn't the lawyer's fault. The lawyer had already rendered his services. Tankersley doesn't benefit from the release of the $25,000.
Yes, he does, Your Honor, because it is an obligation that he has to his attorney, and it's the payment of the $25,000 satisfies that obligation. The lawyer's contract is with his client, not with the court. He may have some sort of expectation that he's going to get the funds, but once those funds were declared in constructive trust, then those funds were to be used only for the benefit of the injured consumers, not for the benefit of William Tankersley or for the benefit of his counsel.
How much time elapsed between declaring these funds to be subject to the constructive trust and the release of the funds to the attorney?
It was a little bit short of 3 months, Your Honor. It was October, and then of 2000, and then the release was made in January of 2001.
Did the district court give any reason for releasing the funds?
Yes. The district court explained that the district court set forth the cases of Amy Travel and I believe World Travel Vacation and Windermere, three other cases in which frozen funds have been released to pay attorneys. However, those cases all involved the release of funds pre-trial. At that stage of the game, those frozen assets still belong to the defendant. The situation here is different. Post-judgment, the court declared that those funds no longer belong to the defendant. Those funds were only held by the defendants as trustees for the benefit of the consumers they injured.
Did the district court give any acknowledge that distinction at all?
No, Your Honor, the district court did not. The Federal Trade Commission argued that strenuously before the court, but the court simply did not recognize the distinction. But it's a very real distinction. The terms of the constructive trust provide that the funds are to be used only for the benefit of the beneficiaries of the trust. In this case,
the judge who imposed the constructive trust, he could have worded it differently. He could say it's all for the consumers, except a portion for legal services already rendered. Let me ask you about the fraud. If an advertiser says, satisfaction guaranteed or your money back, as long as he gives you your money back, isn't he honoring his promise? It's in the alternative, so.
Your Honor, what they claimed was they had an unconditional money back guarantee. In fact, That's what the telemarketers claim, and that's in the telemarketing sales script, which is docket number 404, page 613. When consumers actually received the material and they opened up the package, there was a guarantee in there, but the guarantee then had conditions. Now, there is evidence that some of their employees routinely made refunds to consumers, but there's also undisputed other evidence that before those employees got the packages to make the refunds on, the refund requests that came in were filtered through another office. And at that other office, consumers who had paid by check debit, by and large, unless they happened to live in Wisconsin, Illinois, Indiana, Michigan, or Ohio, they had their refund request simply discarded. That's also undisputed in the record. It's also undisputed that consumers who paid by check debit had substantial conditions that they had to meet. Presumably, consumers who discovered those conditions who couldn't meet them, and they had to prove that they had kept the materials for 90 days.
Okay, but now you're saying the promise of an unconditional guarantee was phony. But you said in your brief, that you implied in your brief, citing a Montgomery Ward case, that even if the unconditional, the promise of your money back was entirely fulfilled, it still would not dissolve the false claim.
That's right, Your Honor. A money back.
Why is that?
A money back. They are not free to say, we guarantee you will score 95 on the Postal Service employment test or your money back, and then walk away free from their claim that you will score 95. If that were the case, anybody could claim anything, and that's what the Montgomery Ward case says.
I know,
anybody,
but that's the question. Why is that? I mean, in the law of contracts, we allow people to promise the impossible. As long as it's understood that if the promise is not fulfilled, they have to pay damages. So why isn't it the same thing?
Because, Your Honor, in the law of consumer protection, what happens is plenty of consumers, as in this case, simply pay the money and don't claim their money back guarantees. It's a very profitable venture. It's a very profitable venture to make all sorts of...
What would be the amount that they would be claiming?
That consumers would claim?
Yeah.
The consumers...
I mean, how much money had they paid that they would be asking back?
$46.
So you're saying, really, well, $46, a lot of people just write it off rather than...
Yeah, they write it off. Perhaps they're embarrassed. Perhaps they just don't want to make the request. It could be a very profitable venture if you simply make a claim and then back it up with a money-back guarantee. If the court has no other questions...
Okay, thank you.
Thank you,
Mr. DeMille. Mr. Bauer, how much time? 2 minutes?
Judge, Your Honors, I think that the district court judge that established the constructive trust retained control and jurisdiction over those assets, and it was clearly within her discretion to make an allowance of attorney's fees as what has been outlined by the various cases, not only cited by the magistrate at the trial level, but also in our brief. There is one other factor on that particular issue that I think is very important. I feel that there's a little bit difference when you're talking about an allowance of attorney's fees that it's in a civil matter, as opposed to when you're looking at a criminal matter and you're attempting a forfeiture. The whole constructive trust by the district court judge was to try to establish a fund out of which the consumers could be repaid for whatever their damages were determined to be later on. That's not quite the situation in that there is no allegation that all of the assets owned by the Tankersley were in fact as a result of this fraudulent telemarketing scheme, if in fact there was one. So there's never been a judicial determination that all of the monies in the possession of the court ordered on the constructive trust were the result of this illegal activity. And so I think it was within the trial court judge's discretion to do what she did.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Bauer. Thank you to both counsel. Next case for argument.